The Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, Mondays at 5 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, and Medication Madness? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy and how you can make the most of your own life right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan. And in my never-ending quest to keep up with modern biological psychiatry, I want to give you the latest bad news. You can Google it. It came out today. There's an article about it in the Wall Street Journal and many other sources. A study of the diagnosis of ADHD in 2009 showed a great increase, so that nearly one out of 10 of our children today across the country, 10%, have diagnoses of ADHD at any given time, because this is a survey of prevalence at the moment. So you can figure that way above that number are the kids that are getting diagnosed ADHD, well beyond 10%. And they're getting psychiatric drugs. And that doesn't even include the kids labeled bipolar and depressed and anxious and oppositional defiant disorder. We are drugging a huge chunk of our population. But even a place as sophisticated as the Wall Street Journal doesn't have the faintest idea of the implications of this. The article in the Wall Street Journal, for example, says that there's no chance that this is overdiagnosis because the diagnostic criteria are so strict. I mean, you have to have this disorder in more than one place and setting, and you got to meet all these criteria. And they write it down in the Wall Street Journal like that's a fact, when in reality, this diagnosis is made when mom goes to the pediatrician and says, my teacher thinks my kid needs Ritalin, or my teacher says my kid is hyperactive. And the guy looks at the kid and sees he's not hyperactive, but knows he's hyperactive somewhere else and prescribes Ritalin for him. It's made very cavalierly. And then the Wall Street Journal quotes experts on this subject of how important it is that we're diagnosing these kids because they cause so much damage and destruction. And who's the expert? Well, it's CHAD. It's CHAD, that organization that I blew the whistle on way back in the early 90s in toxic psychiatry, that organization that Senator Grassley has been investigating because it gets so much money from, guess who? Drug manufacturers, especially of stimulants. We're in a sad and desperate state in this country when we are drugging such a large percentage of our population of children. And by and large, in my experience, they're the best kids. These are the kids full of what we used to call piss and vinegar before we diagnosed ADHD. These are the kids who are full of life and sometimes unhappy and restless and rebellious and angry sometimes too. And of course, they're often among our best. But instead of looking at the boring schools, the inappropriate teaching, the teachers you can't get rid of no matter what, instead of looking at parents confused and having a hard time raising their kids who need to learn to discipline better, instead of looking at the wonderfulness of these kids, we just diagnose the kids. We really need to be looking not at the kids. We need to be looking at the drug companies, at my mental health profession led by psychiatry. We need to be looking at the schools. We need to be looking at our families. And we need to treasure our children and to stop the drugging. My guest today, I'm looking forward to this show. Her name is Gail Rosentine, R-O-Z. A-N-T-I-N-E, Gail Rosentine, Ph.D. I'm looking at a very nicely done book that she's written. It's called, I love the title, At Ease, Soldier. Isn't that a great title? At Ease, Soldier. How to Leave the War Downrange and Feel at Home Again. And I'm turning to, you can get this book on Amazon.com, At Ease, Soldier, Gail Rosentine. And I'm looking at page 107, and I really like what she does. She's got a picture of a soldier sort of on the ground, obviously in distress, and this is about battle mind. And she compares what happens to you in combat to how you react at home. And I'll be brief about it. In combat, you got buddies and cohesion. At home, you don't, and you go into withdrawal. In combat, you've got this tremendous accountability for being totally in control of everything you do, and your survival and the survival of your buds depends on it. At home, it becomes over-control, overreacting. In combat, you target aggression. You're just up. You're just up for split-second decisions. At home, that becomes excessive anger, inappropriate anger. In combat, you got tactical awareness. I'm quoting Gail now. Your survival depends on your being alert and aware of your surroundings at all times. And at home, that's hypervigilance. You feel keyed up and revved up all the time. In combat, you're lethally armed. At home, you wish you were locked and loaded. You feel like you need that kind of defensiveness. In combat, the priority is on emotional control. At home, that leads to anger and detachment and an inability to relate. I like this because it's looking at what the soldier needs to do in combat and how it's not a disorder, but rather just a continuation, a perseveration, a totally understandable continuation on the home front where it doesn't work. So welcome, Gail Rosentine, Ph.D., to my show. I'm hoping we'll have a really good talk about stress and helping people look at various kinds of stresses. But welcome aboard.
Well, thank you, Peter, for inviting me to join you. And I appreciate your good description of parts of the book. I really do appreciate that very, very much. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, you're welcome. Why don't we just start with this whole idea of stress and how you work with it, what causes it?
All right. Let me just explain a little bit about what my husband and I do here in Savannah, Georgia.
Oh, that's a better way to start. Go ahead.
Let me just begin, and as I describe it, you'll understand how stress and teaching people how to deal with stress is at the core of what we do. My husband, Barry, is a psychiatrist, so he does medication management, psychiatric evaluation, and we definitely appreciate your approach to medication, because part of what he finds often is that people are seeking medication. They're already convinced they need it. By the time they get to him, he has to educate them about alternatives, let's say. Now, his job is to do what he has to do for patients when they come, but he very much encourages them to engage in a therapeutic process so that they can use as little medication or no medication. And then I'm the psychologist, so I do the talk therapy. We have a center here called the Center for Health and Well-Being, and we have tried to provide a very soothing and peaceful atmosphere. We have koi ponds. We have waterfalls. We have aromatherapy. We have quiet music. The TV with no sound, with planet Earth. So people come in, and from the moment they come in, we are trying to help them reduce their stress. And then the program goes on from there. So that's our approach. Stress is at the core of the problems that bring people in to see us. and we help them identify that and learn how to deal with it.
Do you work closely together as husband and wife?
Well, we work, of course, in the same facility, and we have our building has a corridor all the way around with staff in the middle, and Barry's on one side, so his waiting room looks a little bit more clinical. It has more chairs. You know, it's more that
yes.
doctor's office look. My mm-hmm. side has a library, a recliner, the sofa. It's more like coming to a home or a living room. Now, some
By
people,
the way, that's yeah. how my office looks, Gail.
And it's soothing. People, from the moment they come in, most know that, oh, I'm going to get some help here, because we have made it inviting. And it makes a huge difference, doesn't it, Peter?
Yes, I'm actually glad to have you talking about it. I think patients listening and clients listening, as well as people who deliver health services, really could benefit from hearing you. I'm in total agreement. You want to create a welcoming, warm, home-like, caring environment. People feel better the minute they walk in, and they feel the relief of not walking in to a traditional medical office.
Yes. So, you know, our approach is one that we know when people come to see us, they are stressed, whether it is a job stress, whether they have family issues, whether in today's economy they have financial issues, whether they have children who are highly anxious. Our opinion is that ADHD is an anxious brain, and that's part of what we see, is very anxious children who are acting it out in ways. And it's almost tragic when parents bring children in and practically insist that they be medicated, because as we join you in saying, that's doing so much damage that people don't realize. But we try to create a comfortable environment where people can talk about things that are not comfortable. So that's our staff, we are so thankful for our staff, because they are welcoming and pleasant and kind as well. So that's our approach. We bring them in. And so Barry and I work as we need to together. Some people only want medication. They don't want to do therapy. Some people come to me and they don't want medication. And I'm very encouraging of that. Let me teach you what you can do so that you use as little or no medication. That's our approach.
Well, that's terrific. Very, very good. Now, let's talk about the therapy, the help that you give. Mm-hmm. When that person's in the office, what goes on? What kind of help do you give? What's, you know, approach it theoretically, approach it practically, and in a way that's going to help our listeners who are therapists and who have stress.
Yes. Well, with Barry's side, you know, we each have our own paperwork. So he's going to get a history of, you know, what kinds of medications they've been on, et cetera, and so forth. But on my side, we actually built this office about 9 years ago, and one of my specialties is what you call health psychology. So I learned stress management very long time ago in a behavioral modification class. So it changed my life and actually put me in a direction where I was interested. I was learning how devastating stress can be and how important it was to learn how to manage it. So years and years ago, at the very beginning of my training in clinical psychology, I was introduced to that. So what happened over time is in my graduate training, I went more and more toward stress and learning about it. I trained with biofeedback, actually trained with someone who had worked with David Spiegel, who did some very important work on the benefits of stress management and group psychotherapy for metastatic breast cancer patients. So I had this intense training in various ways. So when we moved to Savannah, we're not from here. We moved here about 11 years ago. We were here for a while. We built the office, and I thought, you know, everybody who comes to see me needs to learn stress management. Everybody. I'd been giving cassettes away, but this gave me an opportunity to build a facility with special rooms. And in those rooms, my patients undergo or are exposed to stress management training as a part of treatment.
Now, are you doing the training or somebody else is, or it's on videotape?
The way it works is this. A person comes in, and let's say they are coming to see me. Before I see them for the first time, they complete a rather extensive family and history, medication, everything I can glean in their own writing. So it takes quite a while, and it gives them an opportunity to think about some things that are going to be important in treatment. So they complete it, and then I bring them back to my office, and we go over what they've written. That usually takes a half an hour or so, just a thumbnail sketch. And then at the end, I explain to them that, we've already identified their stressors, and that the training is going to include stress management as an integral part. So I explain to them that the next time they come in, they watch a 15-minute video that I produced that we just simply show them here. And it explains about how stress affects the different systems, the benefits of stress management training, and I teach them diaphragmatic breathing and explain that's going to trigger your recovery system. So, and then I explain that after they do that, they will go into one of our relaxation rooms. Now, we took a lot of care to create a contained environment in which they can they can adjust the lighting. They have a surround sound system that actually delivers a nature sound, ocean, rain, mountain stream, or fire. And so they choose their nature sound, and the staff gets them comfortable. We have leather recliners. We have a big granddaddy bear chair because we've got some tall people here, soldiers included. We have a little bit smaller, so people can recline or sit up, whatever's comfortable.
By themselves at this stage.
Absolutely. They are in the room. And so the staff starts the nature sound, closes the door, and I've already prepared them for this. Then they hear little bells, and a second recording comes on that is about a 25-minute relaxation session that I've recorded. Now, it was popular. As soon as people started doing it, they started coming out going, "Oh, Dr. Gale, I need a room like that at home. Oh, my goodness." And so eventually people asked me to create CDs, which are also on Amazon. People can buy those to replicate what's going on. But that's the first phase of treatment, Peter. I knock on the door, and we come back for the face-to-face therapy. If it's a couple, each of them goes into the room, and they get their relaxation. Now, then when we are in therapy, I work from two different approaches. One is psychodynamic, so we go into childhood issues, if there's been a history of abuse, etc. And the other is cognitive in nature. So it's a combination. And then, one last little step, after they have learned the stress management and have become accustomed to going into the room and quieting the mind, then I change what they listen to. I have 35 recordings. Some have to do with inner child work. Some have to do with self-esteem. Some have to do with assertiveness, goal setting, illness, stop smoking. There are 35 I've recorded. So when they come to see me, stress management is the first step because they must learn how to quiet the mind in order to truly benefit from the work that we're doing, I think. Does that make sense?
Well, Gail, we're talking with Gail Rosenthein from Savannah, Georgia, in itself a stress reducer to walk around Savannah, Georgia. I think this is absolutely fascinating because I'm listening to someone who is doing something so different from what I do, except probably for the therapy. I wouldn't be surprised if we do some very similar things. And I'm listening to it, and I'm thinking, that sounds really good. really interesting, and it's so different than anything I do, because I do much more traditional, you know, welcome to my office, and let's talk about what's on your mind. And then I'll go and, you know, we'll do a little cognitive, or, you know, I don't even think in those concepts, but I'll do therapy.
Yeah.
And I'll often do couples, and if I can, family, and when I see children, it's always with the families, pretty much, unless they're teens. But I like what you're doing. It's like you put a lot of thought into it, a lot of work into it, and I think it's very, very interesting what you're doing. How long do people often come to see you? Is there any way you can begin to even describe that, how long you work with folks?
You know, it depends. In the days of managed care, this is a frustration for many. It depends. For instance, we're fortunate to work with a large military population here, and this is a part of why the book evolved over time. We were seeing what was happening to the soldiers and their families with these multiple deployments. We are in a large area with a large military complex, so about 40 or 50% of people come, you know, from that population. We are fortunate to see them. We can see them on a weekly basis, and depending on how long they are stationed here, we can work with them for however long they need it. Now, one, you have a lot of people who've had some quite traumatic childhood issues. So some of the people who come have, you know, they have those abuse issues, and that is a longer course of therapy. So we're fortunate to be able to work with this population as much as they need. And sometimes they're here for a year or so on it. Usually what happens, though, is they'll start once a week, and then once they start doing better, it's once every 2, 3, or 4. I even have some people who come maybe once every 3 or 4 months.
Now, how does the insurance cover the time and the stress reduction room?
It's all a part of the psychotherapeutic process. So it's included as a part of the treatment. So
okay.
It's just part of it. So we built all under one. So that works very, very well for us and for the patients. With other patients, unfortunately, they may be limited to 6 or 8 or 10 or 12. A lot of people have maybe 20 sessions. So it's important to really be focused in, and that's why a model like this is effective, because it gives them a tool from the very beginning that enhances the work that they're doing.
Yeah.
So
now tell me his name again. He's a psychiatrist, which
pardon
is...
Pardon me, Barry Rosentine. Correct. Barry,
what?
MD.
Barry.
Yeah, and I'm Gail.
Do you ever go to him and say, "Hey Barry, honey, maybe Joe doesn't need so much medication"?
Well, if I have an idea of that, I don't hesitate at all, and I let patients know early on that he and I don't discuss the contents of the treatment, because that is confidential. But if I have a concern about medication, I certainly have no problem, and they understand it. They appreciate that. If I have a concern that someone seems over-medicated, or they are describing side effects that are really sound troubling, I don't have a problem at all either leaving a note, mentioning it to my staff, because, you know, they can convey that information, encouraging the patient. But often I will leave a little note, you know, check about the medications, see what's going on with that. And so that works very well. We're sort of a mom-and-pop shop. That's the way people like it, because we're doing a corrective emotional experience here, because some have had pretty poor experiences with their parents. So it's good to feel that mom and dad can take care of them, so to speak, I guess.
Well, I think that's just wonderful. You know, my wife works with me, but not any part of the therapy, Ginger. But she's around, and she meets my patients, and they love to meet her. It gives them a real sense of a reality, and they always feel like just her presence, and, you know, comforts and inspires them. And then my Shetland sheepdogs come out.
Oh, and you know what? We have therapy dogs. We do too, Peter. Do your dogs come out?
Oh, yes, they visit. They decide whether to go into the session or not.
Well, and it's interesting because my little dog is a little, about a 5.5-pound little mixture. And her name is Angel. She's a little, what they call a Mickey dog. They're very good therapy dogs. And Barry's is 3.5 pounds.
No, God. Well, the Shelties are a little bit bigger than that. We can go to a break now. When we come back, let's talk some more deeply about stress, what it is, how it relates to the overall issues that we deal with mental health.
Yes. Wonderful.
Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
This is Dr. Peter Breggin. I'm really enjoying today. Some of you have listened to my show, have heard me many times ask therapists, what do you do? What do you do? What goes on in the room? And we don't get very far often. It's just hard. But Gail Rosentein and her husband, who's not with us, but maybe on another show will be, who is a psychiatrist, Barry Rosentein, they've really developed a systematic approach to therapy. It's not what I do, but it sounds to me like it's probably helping people and helping them a lot. Welcome back on again, Gail.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Talk some more about your ideas about stress and maybe some about the psychotherapy aspects of it. Do you think stress is like the universal cause, or is it an aspect of other things people struggle with? How do you view it?
Well, you know, we all live with stress, and a certain amount of stress is not damaging. In other words, it motivates us. You know, the everyday things, everyday little things that we have to deal with. So stress in and of itself is not always a bad thing, but it's when we feel overwhelmed, that's when it really becomes a damaging kind of a factor in our lives. And it's very interesting. Peter, I love to read. I read a lot of different things. I like to do a lot of reading of current research. So I sort of try to stay abreast of what are the findings. And there have been some very interesting studies in recent years about the effects of stress on our immune system, so that whole area of psychoneuroimmunology. But there, I want to mention that something that has really validated what we're doing here in terms of stress management is some work by a psychiatrist at Emory. His name is Charles Raison, and Chuck is the clinical director of the Mind-Body program there at Emory. And I've had the great pleasure to get to know Chuck a little bit, and we've talked a little bit about possibly collaborating on some research over time. But one of the things that Chuck is interested in is the effect of meditation, which of course is different but similar to a relaxation session in that it's focused, it focuses in on the body, and the meditation that he has studied is what you call compassion meditation, where people are focusing on their heart and increasing their compassion. Well, what Chuck has found in his studies with students there at Emory is that compassion meditation actually reduces inflammation in the body. So that what they've done is to compare students who practice compassion meditation versus students who don't. They've taken blood samples, and the inflammation biomarkers are lower in the ones who practice the relaxation, the meditation. So that's very interesting. And then there is I know I've gotten sort of far afield, but I try to educate my patients because they really want to learn as a part of therapy.
Oh, I think that's really true. You haven't gone far afield at all. You've gone to the heart of the matter. I've never heard of this before. Compassion meditation.
Compassion meditation.
Do you know enough about it to talk about it for a few minutes?
Can
Can you talk about that for a few minutes? What is that? What instruction does the person get to encourage? How is that done? I think it fits so much with this whole concept of, well, of course, our organization is called the Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy.
Yes.
What could be more empathic, I guess, than compassion meditation? Talk about that some, Gail, please.
And see, I am not an expert on that at all. Now, Chuck, you know.
You don't know how he sets it up or what he does?
Well, I know that what they do is they have the students go through the training for it, and they have a regular practice of it. Now, as I understand it, and I'm no expert in compassion meditation, but it is an exercise where they are imagining being compassionate toward various people. It could be people who they have disagreements with. It could be people across the world. But as I said, I'm not an expert in the compassion meditation. I know that he's doing that work, and I'm fascinated with it. Because, as you know, Peter, inflammation appears to be at the basis of all illness, including depression. Inflammation, the biomarkers, the protein, fibrinogen, I can't say it right. Anyway, it's the inflammation biomarkers. These are the ones that are lower when people are able to practice that positive emotion. So that
I'm not sure that any of those kinds of markers are causal. I think that all stress produces changes. It's kind of this business with cortisol, where my colleagues were arguing that depression had something to do with cortisol and the way the body put out cortisol or failed to put out cortisol. And, of course, it was just that stress does these things.
Exactly. So when people learn, whether they are learning a meditation practice, which some people would object simply because and we're in the South, so, you know, we approach a meditative process from a behavioral medicine, which is relaxation, which is focusing. It's really focusing on breath and relaxing the muscles of the body. It's something that you would call a covert progressive muscle relaxation. It's not tensing and relaxing. It's mindfulness. And that's what is similar about what Chuck Raison is doing and what I'm doing is the focus and the relaxing and the positive results.
You know, when you talk about something like compassion meditation, you're deeply into the, I think, the most profound lessons of religion. And of course, the Judeo-Christian tradition is about compassion, if nothing else.
Yes.
And Do you have any particular spiritual or religious orientation that you bring in, or are you wholly secular in the way you think about these things?
It depends on the person who's sitting in my room.
Yeah, I was really asking more about yourself how you feel about it.
Yeah, I have an appreciation of religion in general. In other words, I think there's wisdom in the indigenous and in the Native American. I'm very fond of the teachings of the Dalai Lama. I'm not Buddhist, but I think his approach to compassion and, you know, mindfulness and so forth. I'm very respectful of the Judeo-Christian perspective, the wisdom that all of the different religions really bring. They, you know, most teach the same, which is love other people, be kind and compassionate and accepting, instead of, engendering hatred and divisiveness and so forth. So from my perspective, I'm respectful of what people bring. I have people who are Christian, who are Jewish. I have some Buddhists. There are people who have no faith at all. Therefore, I'm careful about that. So some people don't, they're not interested in metaphysics, and they're not interested in spirituality, and I'm respectful of that. So you meet a patient where they are.
Exactly right. Oh, totally right. I think of therapy as meeting someone where they are and then seeing if you can be helpful in nudging, encouraging, or understanding a better direction for them. But you got to be right with the person you're with. You have to be able to love that, bear that, understand that, and have compassion. I deeply believe, Gail, that being compassionate and being crazy are totally incompatible, and that to the degree that we feel compassion for others and love life, love God, if we believe that, as I do, if we have this love in us and compassion, which I think is love centered around an understanding of suffering and failure, perhaps is a way to say what compassion is. It's not just love. It's a love with understanding for human failure and human suffering. If you have that, you can't be psychotic. You can't be obsessive compulsive and on and on and on and on, because you're fully experiencing yourself at the best.
Absolutely. And can with oneself. And I think when people come to see us, often the most stressful thing in their lives is they feel out of tune with themselves. And often that's reflected in their interpersonal relationships, because when it comes right down to it, probably the most stressful thing in a person's life is relationships that are troubled, and that's where that's, because ultimately whether it's a job stress, a financial stress, those kinds of things play themselves out interpersonally, and people suffer when they feel that they're misunderstood. So part of what we try to do, and on mentioning Barry and the way that the perspective that he takes with his patients, he likes to spend time with them. You know, some doctors, some people come in and they say, wow, it's really good that you listen to me and you're spending the time for me. You know, so in today's managed care, numbers seem to be so important to people, you know, to the bottom line, to the companies and so forth. But we really try to help people understand, we know you're suffering. What can we do to assist you in that and help them to feel comfortable exploring whatever it is that's stressing them? Because if we can reduce the stress, Peter, we can help them be healthier in their mind and their body, because it's a mind-body. It's all one. If they're not happy in their mind, then their body's going to reflect it. And if they're not healthy in their body, then it's going to affect the mind. So we try to help people understand that.
Yeah, I'm totally with you. I think you have a lot of wisdom. And, I mean, it's interesting to me. You've done very little radio from what you told me. You're wonderful. You're a wonderful guest.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to, you know, to have the opportunity. This is just wonderful to be a part of what you are doing for people. Thank you so much.
Oh, well, that's great. I'd love to see if we could find a place for you to do at least a workshop at our conference this April 13th, 14th, and 15th of 2012 in Syracuse. Mm-hmm. I think our plenaries are full, but maybe I'd love to talk to you and your husband about whether you, either one of you or yourself would like to do a workshop, because I think that you're doing really good work, and I like that you have a system as well as the kindness and the caring. Let me ask a specific question that I think is just always worth looking at. When you're dealing with someone who's been horribly abused as a child, emotionally, physically, sexually, what do you bring to that as a therapist? How do you think about it? What do you talk with the patient or client about? Could you talk a little about that?
Sure. Well, here again, as you know, you meet the patient where they are. My intake includes description. In other words, I ask a question, they fill it in, write it in. And there, of course, is a space where, have you ever been sexually or physically abused? And people will sometimes give particulars. Sometimes they'll just say yes or no. So as I'm going through the intake, getting their history, I'll come to that section and I'll notice that you have indicated you've been abused. Can you talk about that? And sometimes people say, Yes, and sometimes people say, well, I'd rather not right now. Most people are quite open. And so I take notes. So they've written and I write, and then when they come back, I pick, you know, when they come back for the next session, after we've done a little check-in, I follow where the patients need to go. So it depends. Sometimes they're right, you know, they want to bring it right up, but usually it comes out in later sessions, and I simply do what we do, which is to validate and mirror back and do what I can to give them the words if they don't have words for that. So it's very much what you do with your empathic therapy. The goal is to be empathic at all times and to let that person feel that they are understood and they are safe and that there is no one judging them and that there's no one blaming them. So it's really a matter of helping them to open that and talk about it as they can.
And you let them know, I'm sure, that you care about them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's something that they feel. Most people feel it when they come in because our facility is so different. And, we have a website about our center, which is, it's called Quiet Awakening, which is an interesting story in and of itself because that's exactly what I see happening.
Quiet Awakening.
Quiet Awakening. And there's a very interesting story about this, if I have a moment to explain
yes,
it.
Yes, you do.
Because I named the process Quiet Awakening, and so I have the little trademark and all of that because I just do anyway. And it was interesting because in my own private place, I'm very prayerful about my work. I try to stay prayerful at all times as I work with people, whether they're not aware of it, but, you know, I'm knowing that I'm trying to stay sensitive. And so in my own prayer life, I was saying, all right, God, what am I going to call this, you know, this process that I've developed here that has worked so well for now it's almost 9 years. And it was so interesting the way it worked. This woman came in, and she had been in to see me she had been in therapy for a period of time, and then she had taken a little break, and she was not coming back as often, but she was still coming from time to time for a check-in. And so I had been very prayerful about this, and she walked in, and she said, you know, I said, well, you know, how are things going, and how has all this worked for you? And we were just... It was funny, Peter. She looked over at me and she said, you know, Dr. Gale, she said, this is sort of a quiet awakening. And I'm like, there it was. That was the name. Because what she was telling me and went on to say is, as I've been working in therapy, I just feel like I woke up to myself.
It was that's beautiful.
Awakening. And that's what I find, Peter, is that when you give people an opportunity to quiet the mind, and it is stress management. This is stress management. This is relaxation training. When you give them that opportunity and they quiet the mind for the first time, many have never quieted the mind, then they can begin to open to themselves because many people have lost themselves in the process of life. And if they've been damaged a lot, their self was... you know, got lost way back when. If they've immersed themselves in a marriage that's not working out or from family problems, they've lost themselves. So it's a matter of a quiet awakening. And if you go to the website, I have the little lotus that opens, the little sun comes up, and then there's a butterfly. That's the logo for Quiet Awakening because those are symbols, as I understand it, and I'm not an expert in symbols, but the sun is like a universal symbol of the self. The lotus is rebirth, and the butterfly is transformation. So as the lotus opens, the sun comes up, and then there's the butterfly. So that's the quiet awakening. And I've never really talked about it to anyone much before, so you're really the first to hear about that process. But it was beautiful the way this woman came in And it was just an answer to prayer.
Well, just being on the show with you is, I mean, quite literally, is reducing stress. I had one of the most stressful days I've had in years yesterday with good things and difficult things and all kinds of stuff to deal with, and it went on for about 14 hours.
Just
having you on the air with me is peace-giving. And I'm sure that you just are very, very helpful to the people who come to see you. It's interesting. People often tell me that listening to my voice on the air or just, you know, hearing me talk makes them peaceful. You yeah. have that quality to the nth degree of just a sense you communicate as you talk of your own centeredness. And your own peacefulness and your own caring about other human beings. And I think all of that is inextricable. Peace and even and also effectiveness and strength does not come from the moments and times we're centered on ourselves. It comes from the moments and times when we are totally aware of the people around us and as therapists, the people we're focusing on.
Well,
it's really
a
pleasure talking, but go ahead, say some more things.
I was going to say, when you love what you do, and you know, Peter, just as you have the passion for what you do and educating people about the dangers of medications and all that you do, you know, have done for these many, many decades, really, you love what you do. And yes, it's stressful at times, and yes, it can be draining at times, but you know, when you love what you do, it's energizing. And you feel like you're in a flow, and that's the way it feels. It's like, and the book, I have to say, that book, Addie's Soldier, that, again, you've seen it, you've read it, it's written in soldier vernacular, okay? It's like me talking to soldiers. I can get to that place of talking their talk. Well, I also have a clinician's guide that goes with it that I'm now going to help therapists use the book. It is written like a psychologist. So when I was in the flow writing that book, it just came on through. It's like I loved doing it because I knew that it was going to help. It was going to help these soldiers. And there's a story behind that with a Vietnam vet that just loved the work and kept saying, Dr. Gale, you have to do this. You have to do this. So you know, it's when you love what you're doing, it makes all the difference.
I want to return to that idea. One of my patients asked me, a very thoughtful young man asked me, I think it was also yesterday, that busy, busy day, he asked me, what is burnout? And what came out of my mouth is that burnout is when, for one reason or another, you don't love what you're doing.
Exactly.
And the reasons can be many, that you're not supposed to be doing that, you don't want to do that, or you're doing even too much of that.
Exactly.
It's tiring you and exhausting you. But burnout, and I felt I finally had a definition of burnout, it's literally when something is interfering with you loving what you're doing. And some of the work I do, Gail, is I don't love. I do it because I feel instructed to do it. I feel like
yes.
I'm supposed to do it. I'm supposed to, supposed to write these books on brain-disabling treatments in psychiatry.
Yes,
but
yes.
I still get deep gratification from it. So
yes.
Love is a complicated concept. I'll get deep gratification from
yes.
from standing up on these issues, but I don't
yes.
I don't get joy. I don't feel it's a loving experience. So that it's a complicated. There's also
it
other
is.
Gratifications in life.
Yes. Well, writing a book it's hard work. There is no question about it because you are, you know, it's as you said, you feel you have to do it. It's something that you're here to do, but it is very hard work and very demanding, and sometimes a 7 day a week kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
So,
now, therapy is different for me. Therapy is not
yeah.
like that. And writing yeah. certain kinds of books is not like that. But
exactly.
a lot of that reform work you see up there on my page that I've been
yes.
doing since I was 18, literally, I feel like that's not just pleasure and it's not just the love of it. But you know
yes.
what I really realized in recent years? It really comes out of compassion. It really comes out of my awareness of the suffering that my profession inflicts upon other human beings. It really, a lot of that comes out of compassion. There's a lot of this. Love is more complicated than I sometimes admit.
Yes.
We have about 2 or 3 minutes. I want to give you a chance, realizing there's 2 or 3 minutes, to just kind of say what you'd like to say as we finish up. You're a wonderful guest.
Well, thank you so much. And I, again, thank you for inviting me to join you. I feel very honored and privileged to be a part of your vital work by being a part of your program. I guess the one thing that I would say to the audience is to recognize the importance of learning how to manage stress, to identify what it is that has caused them to be out of the flow, out of touch with themselves. What is it that is creating tension and unhappiness and dissatisfaction? And find ways to manage that, you know, whether it is through yoga, whether it is through acupuncture, whether it is through finding beautiful music, whether it is taking a walk and seeing the beauty of nature. It's finding ways to be in a flow, be connected to self and centered. So that's, I think, if I could teach people anything in the world, if I could just reach as many people to say, please learn how to manage that stress, learn to breathe deeply and honor the body when it's tired and stressed. So I guess that would be what I'd have to say, Peter. And thank you.
I think it's really, really good. In my own language, which I think is totally compatible, I ask people to identify whether they love what they are doing.
Yes.
And to find what they love to do.
Yes.
And when it comes to things that we may at times not love doing, at times raising our kids, at times writing our books, at times going to work, to find a way to be as loving and joyful about it as we can, to always have that goal in mind, to make it a good an experience as possible, even when it's one that we know is arduous, difficult, even terrifying. Gail, I want to thank you for being on. And again, this is Dr. Gail Rosentine. She's from Savannah, Georgia. Works with her husband, Barry, in doing stress management, and as you've heard, in doing a lot more than that as well. I want to remind folks that this is about empathic therapy, and that empathic therapy grows out of who we are and how we want to be with the people we help. It's guided by principles, it's guided by knowledge, it's guided by science. And it is guided by science, but it has a lot to do with how you want to be helped and how you want to help other human beings. Again, thank you for being on. This is Dr. Peter Breggin saying goodnight.
Thank you, Peter. It's a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Breggin and his lifelong reform work on www.breggin.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.